Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.
Small things can cause big trouble.
I know where the Tri-Delta sorority is having their initiation tonight.
Yeah, Felta Delta?
And we just might be able to watch.
They say you've got to start at the bottom to get to the top. And they're right.
Oh!
They say you shouldn't stick your nose where it doesn't belong. And they're right.
Busted.
They say where there's smoke, there's fire. And they're right.
Babs, have a cocktail.
They say curiosity killed the cat. And they're right.
Run!
They say good things come in small packages.
No way out, except my dying.
But this time, they're wrong.
We'll take a back seat. You'll just drink in the back.
You've got to give the devil his due.
Sorority babes.
Welcome to a special episode of The Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Recently, I had the good fortune of speaking to Mr. David Dakota about the upcoming re-release of his film on Blu-ray, the film being Sorority Babes in the Slimeball Bowl-O-Rama. Definitely one of my favorite films. Definitely one of the best film titles that has ever been produced. And yeah, we talked a little bit about that and how the film came about. Also, the extras that are on this new Blu-ray release. We also spoke a little bit about Little Miss Innocence, the remake of the film that he did in 1987, which we spoke about in the Death Game episode a few months ago with Professor Nicholas Schlegel. And we also spoke about some of his more recent things, including A Talking Cat. So be sure to check out this episode. I hope that you enjoy the interview. It was a real pleasure talking to Mr. Dakota. And be sure to pick up the Blu-ray of Sorority Babes in the Slimeball Bowl-O-Rama, available now.
My name is David Dakota, and I'm a cult B-movie director. I've been in the business. Technically, I started as an exhibitor when I was 15 years old. I was working in the movie theaters in Portland, Oregon as a candy counter boy and a projectionist. And then I moved to Los Angeles when I was 18 and started working for Roger Corman as a production assistant and also as a projectionist and kind of an all-around slave boy. I did every single type of job at Roger Corman's. And some of my cohorts there were James Cameron and Bill Paxton and Robert Englund and Zalman King. So we were all at the Roger Corman studios in Venice making a crazy horror movie.
What kind of stuff were you working on those days?
I was on staff at the studio, and I helped in the special effects for the movie Escape from New York. And the big movie we shot there was Galaxy of Terror, and then a little bit on Forbidden World and a movie called Firecracker and a film called Smokey Bites the Dust. So that was about 8 months of working at Roger Corman Studio.
And how did you work your way up to actually directing stuff?
I worked as a production assistant, craft service guy. I worked my way through the camera department, grip electrical department, sound, post-production. I basically learned while I earned, and I worked in every possible department and raised enough money to get my first horror movie going when I was 24. So I worked in every type of industry, everything from, you know, horror movies to commercials to even music videos, adult videos. I was in every single possible subgenre of movies, so, and television and commercials. So I did a little bit of everything. I worked in labs. I worked at drive-in theaters. I was always connected to the movies in some way.
I guess I should ask, was directing kind of your ultimate goal, or what was your ultimate goal when you were doing all these different jobs?
My ultimate goal was I wanted to own a movie distribution company, because I had been in the exhibition business and really loved selling and showing movies and whipping up a spell with promotions and things like that, trying to get people to go to the film. So I was more of a fan, but, you know, really wanted to run my own company. Directing, I started to like when I was a craft service guy, because I saw in some cases when I was working with directors like Ken Russell, I could see how great the job could be. And then there were other directors who were working as 25-hour days, and it was a nightmare. So I thought, well, if I'm going to make movies, I should probably direct them as well, because I'm the most affordable director I know.
Can you tell me about the first films that you directed?
Like I said, I worked briefly about a 3-year period directing adult movies from the age of 21 to 24. And that's what got me the money to get my first horror movie, Going Dream Maniac, which I partnered with Charles Band on. And it was sort of a female Freddy Krueger type succubus film. It was released through Wizard Video, Empire Pictures at the time, Lightning Video, Vestron. And that was the first movie. And the VHS market was a very big market back then, and there were 30,000 video stars, and they all needed new movies on the shelves, so we could not make enough movies. So, and the horror genre is always the genre that was the kind of genre where you didn't need to have stars in the movie for it to be successful. You had to have a clever title, a lot of scares, a lot of sexy women, and a really cool poster. And that's what really made those movies jump off the shelf and got people to rent them. It wasn't that there was some, you know, half-baked movie star in there someplace. So we did really well with horror movies. So that's somewhat of the genre we stayed with. Those movies also exported well out of the United States and various territories. So I stuck with that and started a relationship with Charles Band. And right from Dream Maniac, I went to films like Creepazoids and then on to Sorority Babes and 125 movies later. Still making the same kind of movies. It hasn't changed in 3 decades.
One of your adult ventures was New Wave Hustlers. Was that kind of a play on the New Wave Hookers films?
It was. It was me being clever. New Wave Hookers at the time was released by my friend Russ Hampshire at BCA. I was pretty much providing movies to every single label back then and had a pretty good relationship with the BCA. So I thought I would do sort of a gay spin on it. And so I did New Wave Hustlers. But I shot the whole movie in 6 hours, and it wasn't very good. And so Russ said, nah, that's a pass on this one. So I set it up with my my friend Sal over at LA Video, and he took it off our hands, and we made some money on it. But that was back in the day when you could just really, really make a lot of money in that area, and that's ultimately the business that I didn't really necessarily not like it. It was sort of a stepping stone into something a little bit more legit. But there was a lot of money to be had, so I had to learn while I earned there as well.
When it came to Sorority Babes and the Slimeball Bolarama, what came first with that? You talked about how you might sell a movie on a poster idea or maybe a title. I mean, the title of the film is just amazing, and the poster is pretty darn great, too. What came first? What was your inspiration for that?
I was seeing dailies, which is the footage we shot the previous day on Creepazoids. And we were looking at the dailies, and Charlie Band, who was the financier and boss, my boss at the time, saw the dailies and thought they'd look pretty good. It's the second movie I did for him. And so he offered me a 10-picture deal and then said, why don't you do this movie here that I pre-sold called The Imp? And it was a very exotic piece of art, very much very mystical and creepy and dark and very much like out of a comic book. So he said, here, take the poster. The title is The Imp. Get a script written. I need you to make this movie really quickly because I have to deliver it at the Milan Film Festival. And or what was called MIFED, which was the next to Cannes, was sort of the biggest film market in the world at that time for this type of movie. So we had to move quickly. So we came up with a storyline and hired a writer, Sergei Hantanets. And we were a little bit of a silly mood at that time because there were a lot of films like Reanimator and Return of the Living Dead around that time that were a little over the top funny, didn't take themselves too seriously, but delivered the scares and the gore of the girls. So we thought we would find, and me and my producing partner at the time, John Schuweiler, were always sort of zany madcaps anyways. It was anything for a laugh. And we thought, well, let's just go crazy with this idea. And we put the imp in a bowling trophy. We turned it into a sorority initiation. We set it in a bowling alley and, you know, got a terrific script from Sergei. And we start casting the girls. And Linnea, who had just done Return of the Living Dead and Creepazoids for me, came on. I hired Michelle Bauer from Hollywood Chainsaw Hookers. I hired Ring Stevens from Slumber Party Massacre, Robin Stilley from Slumber Party Massacre, Hal Havens from Night of the Demons, and Carla Baron from Halloween Night, Buck Flower from all those John Carpenter movies. So it was a pretty much an all-genre cast, and we all got in a bunch of cars and drove down to San Diego County and camped out there and shot the movie at night in a bowling alley for 2 weeks.
I have to say, Robin Rochelle's performance, she is she just owns the film in so many moments. What was she like to work with?
She came into audition, and I looked at her and I said, "You look really familiar." I said, "Were you in Slumber Party Massacre?" And she goes, "You saw that movie?" I said, "Hell yes, I saw that movie. You were great in it." And I said, "You want to be in this movie?" And she said, "Absolutely," because she was very tall, very striking, with a blonde bob haircut. She reminded me of a younger Sybil Danning. But she had just finished number one with The Bullet with Billy Dee Williams over at Cannon. And she was working quite a bit. She was a fun girl. I mean, she had a child, but we had fun down in San Diego County. She was a lovely girl. And she just kind of relished the role. I mean, it was sexy, but she didn't have to get naked. She was powerful. She was tough. She got to spank Michelle Bauer and Brink Stevens, which seems to be every young boy's fantasy at the time. So, but she got into it. She's beautiful, photographs like $1 million, and was great to work with. But sadly, such a tragedy that she suffered from a little depression, and there was some things going on in her life. And sadly, Robin Stille, who was a SAG member at the time, and it was a non-union movie, went by the name of, her middle name is Rochelle, so she went by Robin Rochelle. But she had committed suicide. It was really a trial. It was very shocking. It was a number of years later, but it's not like we all kept in touch. I mean, this is before cell phones and internet and email and everything. And people, you know, you finish a movie, you all go your separate ways. And I always kept her in mind. But she was terrific. She was a lovely girl. And but everybody was great in that. I mean, that's the movie, Linnea Quigley. It's her favorite character, Spider, because she's, you know, she saves the day at the end. I mean, these are strong female characters. And I try to turn the genre on its ear and try to make the boys sort of the innocents who needed to be protected, and the girls were strong and made shit happen and saved the day. So, and I had done just that one movie with Linnea, although I did meet her on a short film that I didn't direct, but we met on that, and she was very sweet. And I said, "No, you're not going to get naked in this one, but I want you to be sexy." And she was very open-minded about the nudity, and she didn't really care, but she loved the fact that she didn't have to get naked in this one. But that's a tough role. And we really worked hard, and she did a good job. And, but no, that whole cast was great. I was really, really pleased with the cast.
How long was the shoot?
The shoot was a total of 14 days. The formula back in those days, because this is back in the days of 35 millimeter and equipment rentals and generators and, you know, lots of vendors, you would do a 2 6-day weeks. So basically you would get a 3-day rental or a 2.5-day rental per week. And then for the Sync sound cameras, that was the bigger cameras. So we shot that for 2 weeks. We did 2 days in LA first at a house, the sorority house. And then we all went to San Diego for another probably 10 days with that Sunday off. And then we took the week off and we shot for 2 days at my offices with a Wild Arri, with a more affordable camera. And we shot all a lot of the interiors. We shot a lot of pickup shots and things like that. And so basically it was a total of 14 days, but it was short days because we couldn't really, we had to shoot at the bowling alley at night. So we had to do something like I think it closed at 10 PM. So we kind of started lighting at 9 and we had to be out of there by 8 AM. So we were all nocturnal. It was night shoots are never fun. I had worked on the movie Angel, the Donna Wilkes, Cliff Gorman movie about Catholic high school girl by day, hooker by night. I was the crash service guy in that. I'm actually in the movie as well. That was a 24-day shoot. But we had a really good producer, Don Borchers, and how he scheduled that was we started at 8 in the morning, and then every single day for 24 days, he moved the call time a half an hour. So we were able to work ourselves into nights more organically and less, you know, because when you immediately switch over to nights, it's impossible. Your body clock is not prepared for it. So on that movie, it worked really well. On ours, we had to go right to nights because that's the only time the bowling alley was going to be available to us.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the voice of the imp?
The voice on the set was the operator, which is the man who created the puppet, Craig Caton Largent, who had just been working at Boss Films on Ghostbusters. And but he was an old friend from Portland, Oregon, who had moved to Los Angeles. And so he created it for me. And some trailers, when you hear it, you'll hear it. That's like processed. That was just for the trailer because the movie wasn't finished yet. Kenneth J. Hall, who is a writer that I met through Fred Olen Ray's ex-girlfriend, Miriam Pricelle, who used to be his editor, she introduced me to Kath J. Hall, who was getting ready to do Evil Spawn. And we became fast friends. He's very funny. And he suggested Dookie Flyswatter for the voice. And I did not know who that was. He had a band called Haunted Garage. And so we went to Dookie and I said, could you come in for an hour and do the voice of the imp for me? He was happy to do so. So it was an interesting choice, although it was never intended to be as funky and wild and as ghetto as Dookie's interpretation. But people seemed to love that character. And he added a few extra lines here and there just to be funny, because my Dookie's also a writer. So it was pretty silly. But that was thanks to Ken Hall. He introduced me to him.
So can you clear this up? Dookie Flyswatter, not the same person as Michael Sonnier?
No, yeah, Michael Sonny and Dookie are the same. Michael Sonny is a writer and an actor, and Dookie Flyswatter is his rock and roll persona. Yeah, so it's the same person, but it's a different vibe, and that was what you did in the 80s. You all had a rock and roll name and then when you had a band, and that was his.
I never really made the connection until just recently that he was, what was it, Mengele in Surf Nazis Must Die.
He sure was Mengele. Matter of fact, that's how he was in that. He was also in, he might have been in The Tomb or Armed Response or one of those Fred Olen Ray movies, because I think that's how Ken met him. He was in Surf Nazis Must Die. I tell you, this cast was an all-genre cast. And what was nice about this movie also is the lead kid, Andras Jones, that was his very first movie. He was 18 years old, and I hired him on the spot. He came into audition, and he was terrific. 18 years old, and we did the movie. We had a great time. He was so talented and beautiful and just a great kid. I just knew he was going to be a star, but I didn't realize how quickly, because right after I did the movie, he was cast as one of the leads in Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4. So he really took off pretty quick, and he's terrific in that movie. And he's always been terrific. And he's a dear friend. Whenever he's in L.A., we have lunch. So he's still a dear friend. He's in the radio business. His radio is called Radio 8-Ball on the Internet. And he's a character. He's an amazing guy. Amazing. He does a little bit of acting still, but he's a good guy. So I'm really proud of him. And Hal Havens is doing acting, teaching acting now. But he worked all the time. So it was an interesting cast. I mean, we all kind of, lived in a little hotel in San Diego County. I think we were in San Marcos or someplace like that. And the whole thing was a blur to me, but it worked out pretty well. Nobody would think that 30 years later that we would stumble across the original Cameron egg of this movie in some warehouse in the San Fernando Valley. And so right when Charlie and his team found the negative, I had suggested, well, if you got the original negative, you should do it. This is a popular film because, the film came out obviously on VHS, but it also did the rounds theatrically. The film played on 42nd Street, Sorority Babes. It also played in 20 different film markets around the country. They put 10 prints in each city, and it had to put like 8 month or 9 month release theatrically during the solicitation of the VHS release, which was, it was back when there were 30,000 video stores. So this type of film was pretty popular. So because of that, the film got picked up by the USA Network for a thing they did late night called USA Up All Night. And I think that's where most people saw the movie. And that was a basic cable channel, so you couldn't have any nudity. So it was like 60-minute movie with like 60 minutes of commercials. So that's where people really caught on to the whole Sorority Babes thing. And over the years, the DVD came out, but we were stuck, unfortunately, with a very mediocre one-inch master that was kind of dark and murky. And also the music on Reel 7 was gone, which was the climax of the movie. And we don't know how that happened. But sadly, it went out that way. But we found that original music and we remixed the movie in 5.1. So not only did we scan the original camera negative in 2K and do a full restoration and color correction, but there's a 5.1 mix with the proper music and a commentary track on it. Remarkably, a 2 hour and 15 minute making of. It's a disc where literally the company that was authoring the Blu-ray disc said, you have no more room on this disc. So, because we have the 2 hour, 15 minute making of. Plus, I do a commentary on the 2 hour and 15 minute making of. So I basically I felt that the fans, they wanted to know all the stories and I did everything I could remember. And a lot of those images really triggered memories, good memories and bad memories. And it's everything you'd ever want to know about Sorority Babes is on this Blu-ray. So I suggest people grab it now at fullmoondirect.com because it's going to sell. It's going to sell well because it never looked this good because it was really beautifully shot by a man named Stephen Ashley Blake, who had been David Pryor's cameraman over at AIP for many, many years and David Winter's cameraman. So I hired him on this. He did a bang up job. So very, very happy with this Blu-ray. It's not one of those fake Blu-rays where they just use some old master and just call it a Blu-ray. This is the original camera negative. So I'm really happy with it.
Was the making of done then or was it done now?
Very interesting story because a very good friend of mine, Bob Langer, who is now head of marketing over at Full Moon, I met him many, many years ago. And his brother, Ralph, taught film in high school in Pittsburgh. And he would come out every summer and videotape, get on the set of an independent movie and do some videotaping just to show his students back in Pittsburgh how B-movies are made in Hollywood. So Ralph just did that footage just for his own use. He stumbled across all of that original making of footage that he shot and dumped it onto DVD. I looked at it and I hadn't seen it for 30 years. And I thought I think it's never been released before. No one has ever seen this except his film students and just a handful of people on the set. And he documented the entire process. I mean, I don't think he was there for every day of shooting, maybe a half a dozen days, but he got some great footage. I mean, all of our stunt work prepared and all of our fire body burns, all of our makeup effect, he was able to cover all of this. So Charlie Band's calling this the first video zone ever created. The original intention was to do like a 20-minute video zone. And I thought, well, you know, this is kind of a 30-year anniversary. The fans, you know, don't leave them wanting more. Just give them more than they want. Let's just take out all the shaky camera moments and just string it together as one stream of consciousness. And I did an intro for it and a few little pieces in between to kind of fill in the gaps. And it's 2 hours and 15 minutes, and it's all on that disc. And then I also, like I said, do a commentary on that just to fill in more blanks. Plus, there's a commentary with myself, Bring Stevens, and Sergei Hasanets, the writer, on the feature. And also there's some other interviews. I mean, the Blu-ray disc is jam-packed, full of stuff. And it is the definitive Blu-ray for this movie. But the most important thing, it is from the original camera negative. It's never looked better. And it'll never look better. I mean, it's beautiful. So definitely get your hands on that Blu-ray. I'm really proud of this one.
Was there ever any talk of doing a follow-up to Sorority Babes?
Not really. I think, obviously we introduced a crazy character because he kind of survives at the end. Spoiler alert. No, not at this point. I mean, who knows? We'll see how well this disc does. But if it does really, really well, I'm sure that Charlie will come up with something because he's always very entrepreneurial that way.
Do you have a few minutes? Can I ask you about another one of your films?
Sure.
I wanted to know a little bit more about the making of Little Miss Innocence.
Well, that's a very interesting movie. I rarely talk about my early love stories, Michael, but I will digress and talk about them. I worked for a producer when I was first when I left being a craft service and PA. I said I cannot wait to work my way up to director. So there was an industry in the San Fernando Valley that was extremely active, and there was a lot of people in mainstream that worked in that industry under assumed names just to, you know, make a living. As I said, I like to earn while I learn, and met a lot of producers in that business. And it was back when we were shot on film, you know, learned how to operate the camera, load the mags, work the Nagra, do post sound, dealt with every lab. I mean, it was really just an amazing education for about a year. One producer I worked for named Terry LeGrand, I had a script that I wrote for one, and he let me direct it. And I became one of the busiest directors in that genre. For a couple of years, I was doing probably at the least two movies a month, sometimes four. I worked nonstop. And one of the producers I worked for was a man named Chris Warfield, who's no longer with us. Chris was a very interesting producer. He had been in the business since the 1960s. In the early 80s, late 70s, he got glaucoma and became literally blind. And he needed a script supervisor to help him direct his movies. So I was his eyes. he directed a movie called Sounds of Sex, and I would block out the scenes on the palm of his hand, showing them how I'd have the actors do the scenes. This is back in the 35 millimeter days. He had there was a lot of people in that business that Buck Flower was the production manager. Buck went by C.D. LaFleur. Buck is no longer with us. I don't think he would mind me in the heavens reminding people that he had a very interesting past. That was the producer, Chris Warfield, who said, David, I made a movie back in the 70s that I did really well with called Little Miss Innocence. I'd like to remake it. Why don't you just start directing these movies? And I said, well, you know, I'm happy to be your script supervisor. I'm happy to put it together. But Chris, you're a really good director. As a matter of fact, he was one of the best directors I've ever worked with. And he was clinically blind. But he was a visionary, if you can believe that. And he says, no, I'm not going to direct anymore. There's this newfangled thing called a video camera. And I go, oh, are you saying you want to start shooting on video? And he goes, well, the market right now is strongly in the video area. And he went down to the CES show in Vegas at the Aladdin, which had the big adult expo. There was a line around the block, you know, Sony had nobody in front of it, but the adult video section was lines around the block to sign with all the stars and stuff. And he goes, I think there's a market there. If we can make him for a price, he can do one a month for me. So we decided to start remaking some of his movies, and one of which was Little Miss Innocence, which I shot in 2 days at Jack Margolis's house in the Pink Mansion. Jack Margolis wrote films like Linda Lovelace for President. And I don't know if Jack's around anymore, but he used to rent out his big Pink Mansion for movies. We shot it up there in, I think, about 2 days, or I think 2.5 days. It turned out pretty good. It was a much sassier version than the original 70s softcore. But yeah, that was it. It was a remake. And the thing is Chris Warfield actually sang the theme song. We used the theme song from his original 70s version in our 80s version. And it's a little old crooning, you know, piano playing, drunken beer bar kind of song. But it's a nutty movie. But I got to work with Eric Edwards and people like that. That was my experience. So I was directing a lot of movies back then. And like I said, it's not that I don't feel comfortable about talking about my early love stories. It's just, you know, I've made 120 movies since then, and I directed probably about 80 adult movies. And in those 3 years, I made a lot of money, and I really learned while I earned. I learned how to be efficient. I dealt with all the vendors and labs and equipment, and I learned so much. Setting the subject matter aside, it's the same thing. It's got a beginning, middle, and end. It's 80 minutes, and you have to deliver it to a distributor. And back then, you have to have storylines because the films had to have social redeeming value. So, and I was always interested in shooting the storyline stuff, the acting, all that kind of stuff. The meat and potato stuff, or what they used to call the commerce scenes, were very boring to me, and we would get it done, and I would move on to more storyline stuff. So that's probably why I worked so much, is because I always tried to deliver a movie. Whether I had a day or two or 3 days at the most to make these movies, I always try to make them look like a real movie. At least I tried. But again, I was very young. I mean, I started directing those films when I was 21 years old.
We actually talked a lot about Little Miss Innocence, both the original and your version of it, on an episode that we did recently about Knock Knock and Death Game.
It's very interesting. You know, the editor of the original Little Miss Innocence was Ray Dennis Deckler. It's so odd when you think about it, because it was all the same group of like 12 B-movie guys. Peter Perry, Ray Dennis Deckler, Chris Warfield, Buck Flower, John Hayes, who went by, can't remember what his name was, but all the same guys. And we would jump in this and jump into that industry and bounce back and forth. And I had always done both genres. I did gay and straight because I'm gay and I had no issues with either one. I was happy to work. But it was a very interesting time because there was a lot of money to be made. I mean, this is back when a VHS was sold for $80. So it was a different market.
You had a recent film that really set the internet on fire for a little bit there, a Talking Cat film. How did you come to make that one?
I decided to do about a half a dozen, 7 or 8 family films, because at the time, a lot of my international sales reps are saying, Dave, you know, maybe you could do something family oriented. And I had done directed Pre-Hysteria 3 for Full Moon Paramount. I had done a few other family style movies, Christmas Spirit with Alexandra Paul and Maureen McCormick and Judy Landers and people like that. And so I had experimented in the family film, the G-rated business. So I said, okay, let me see what I can do. What was very popular at the time was talking animals. So I said, let me just do a bunch of talking animals movies. So I did a film called The Halloween Puppy, about a woman's boyfriend turns into a dog by accident. Christine DeBell was in it and Eric Roberts. And then I thought, well, there's not a lot of movies. There was also a lot of talking dog movies, but not a lot of cat movies. And I just thought, well, you know, I seem to see more cat videos on Facebook than dogs. So I think there's a market for a cat movie. So, you know, I went to the writer, Andrew Helm, and I said, look, I got to make a movie about a talking cat. So he wrote, it was called The Human Whisperer, was the name of the script, The Human Whisperer. And we cast Johnny Whitaker from Family Affair. That was my first film with him. I was a big fan of his when I was a little boy. Christine DeBell, who I was doing a series of films with, I kind of brought her back into the business after she left for about 20 years, 25 years. And I brought her back and gave her about 5 movies in a row just trying to get her career going again. I mean, she had been on Playboy, the cover of Playboy twice. She was quite something back in the day, and she is a lovely woman now. And I adore her, and she's a good friend. But I brought her in, and then I was going to do the cat talking was going to be probably like a kid or something, you know, because I thought it could be fun. And then it was the weirdest thing. We edited the movie, and we were getting ready to record. I go, I wonder what Eric is up to, because Eric was my neighbor. He only lived a few blocks from me, and he was doing quite a few films for me. And so I called up Eliza and Eric's agent, Peter Young. I said, listen, what's Eric doing this afternoon? And they go, well, you know, he works a lot, but he happens to be home. I said, well, I'm doing this kids movie about a talking cat. Can I just email the script over and I'll come down with the microphone and the computer and, you know, we can have Eric do the voice of the talking cat? I said, sure. So I went over. And I forgot the microphone for the camera. And Eric was only going to be there for like an hour or half an hour. So I said, if I better get this done, I'll just have Eric Roberts as the voice of the talking cat. So so he's reading right up the page. And I got my camera set up. And I didn't have a microphone. So I had to use the microphone on my video camera. So I tried to get that really close to him. And it didn't sound so good. But he went ahead and just read the lines wild. We cut them all in. Movie comes out. It was something, and people just went crazy for it. Netflix took it, which was really exciting for me. It did well on Amazon. I mean, it's that movie is a phenomenon. I mean, it became, like you said, an internet sort of sensation, and because it is so over the top, and that's really what those family films needed to be, because there was, you know, the family film kids movie business is a very flooded business. But there's a lot of content out there. So I wanted to do something with names and a little bit more zany and over the top and kind of ridiculous. Because the more over the top you get, you really – I mean, that internet, social media keeps that movie alive and kind of creates an awareness, because, you know, there's like 100, 200 movies coming out a week. So I was really pleased with the success of that film. You know, I shot that movie in 3 days. You know, I'm really happy with it. I think it's a hilarious movie. I didn't realize how ridiculous it was until I saw it again a couple of years later. And I'm like, my God, this movie's nuts. Yeah, it's crazy. I think I'm not sure if it's on Netflix. It was a 2-year license. I'm not sure if they're renewing it or not, but very, very crazy movie. But look, Christine DeBell and Johnny Whitaker and Eric Roberts. I mean, you know, and a talking cat and that damn cat. That cat, you know, I use the same animal trainer all the time. And so I go, I need a cat. He goes, Dave, I got Duffy. Was it Duffy? Not Duffy. Duffy was the character name, but the real one was called Stinky or something. I can't remember the real name of the cat. Dave, don't worry. We've been training this kitten since it was a little. We've trained this cat since it was a little kitten. This thing is great. Well, the cat showed up and it just was not happy. Somebody would, you know, drop a pin in Fresno and the cat would jump and run away. So I had to shoot around it. And then Johnny comes up to me on the first day and says, Dave, when I was on Tom Sawyer, I worked with a lot of cats. I mean, a lot of animals. The animals love me. When I was on Family Affair, we had Sigmund of the Sea Monster. The animals love me. Watch, I'll do the scene and I'll show that cat exactly how much it's loved, and it's not going to be a problem. So watch this. Go ahead and roll camera. I rolled camera. He walks up to the cat. The cat's like, meow, meow. just almost attacks him. It's just like, poor, It's the scene on the patio, by the patio. It's like the cat just hated everybody. So what I did was, is I shot the movie out in 3 days, all the principal photography, and tried to do as many shots with the cat before the cat would take off. And I went back for another half a day at the house, and I shot just – it was just me, the cat, the trainer, and the camera and one assistant. And we did all the stuff where there was not a lot of people around, which got a little people – you know, got the cat, which just was really aware of just people and was just freaking out. So we tried our hardest, and we treated the cat as much as we could, but it was a nightmare. But we got it done, and it's – the film's a hit. We might make a sequel. Who knows?
So A Talking Pony is not – the sequel to that?
Talking Pony was just one of many talking animal movies. And Talking Pony, I brought Christine back, not playing the same character. I brought Jason Font back from Power Rangers. And then Johnny Whitaker did the voice for me on that one. And some new kids. And the one lead kid, James Lastovic, is now – it was his first movie when he was 18. Now he's on Days of Our Lives. And so, no, that film was shot – that was a quick one. That was shot in 2 days. And didn't have to make the horse's mouth move, thank God, because we attempted to make the mouth move on a talking cat, but we tried – and it just – what we tried to do a CGI thing, but what happened was it just looked so disturbing when the lip flaps were – and so we just put a little black thing in, and I think in the edit software you can do a little thing, but we couldn't sync it up with the mouth. And so we just kind of had that little black thing. It was like, meh, 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 meh. It was just kind of a, that didn't work. So we said, to hell with it. We'll just, she hears his voice. He's talking telepathically or something. So A Talking Pony is also called A Ponytail, and it's available at Walmart and all fine retail establishments. So that one's quite a hoot. That one, Santa's Summer House, it was the Christmas movie I cast like The Expendables. So you go check that one out. What else did I do? Halloween Puppy. That one, I did one called – oh, and My Stepbrother is a Vampire, which I'm really happy with. That's with Judson Burza from Survivor, Dee Wallace, Lynn Lowry, William McNamara, Tracy Nelson. I mean, I had the whole hee-haw gang in that one. I'm pretty proud of that one too. That one's actually a very cute little movie, and really, really happy with that one. But no, it's been a really interesting – the family films have just taken on a life of their own, which is great, you know?
It's so amazing to look at your filmography and see that you have like at least 7 films coming out this year.
I've been doing about one a month for the past 5 or 6 years. I directed a Tom Berenger Western for Lionsgate. I directed a movie called Knock 'Em Dead, which was a labor of love, which is a kind of an old manor house murder mystery thriller with an all African-American cast. And that's all star cast. It's Radon Chong and Anne Marie Johnson, Deborah Wilson from Mad TV, Jack A. Harry, Christopher Judge, Phil Morris, Omarosa's in it, Betsy Russell's in it. So that one I'm really proud of. I think that's still on Netflix. Definitely check that one out. It's kind of a silly comedy. Some more horror films. I did a whole series of films called 1313, which were really successful. And right now I'm doing some films here in Canada under it's 6 movies called The Grimm's Urban Legends. First one is Evil Exhumed, which is a mummy movie with Eric Roberts. Just finished Asian Ghost Story with Cynthia Rothrock, which is a horror, martial arts, kind of fantasy action thriller. And right now, as a matter of fact, we're spotting Bloody Blacksmith with Nick Mancuso. Nick was the voice of the killer of Black Christmas. He was a Nightwing, legendary genre actor. And I start a thriller in a couple of weeks. And then I'm off to L.A. to get my Christmas. I got some Christmas movies I have to make because it's August and we got to make them in August so they can air this Christmas. So it's been a really busy time. I'm just going crazy up here and down there. And I've got a couple movies on Lifetime right now with Vivica A. Fox. Vivica and I like working together. And so she and I co-produced a movie called The Wrong Child, which is airing on Lifetime right now. And I also have The Wrong Child. That's The Wrong Child, The Wrong Roommate out with Vivica, Eric Roberts, and a few others. So I like to keep working. So
it seems like it. Yeah, you seem like a pretty darn busy guy.
Well, I do have 4 films coming out in for Halloween. October 1st. The Evil Exhumed Mummy movie with Eric Roberts comes out, as well as Asian Ghost Story and Teen Warlock. Teen Warlock is 666 Teen Warlock, actually, is with Hilary Shepherd and Jason Fawn from Power Rangers. are in it. That's kind of a teen comedy. And then I also have Sorority Slaughterhouse coming out. That's with Eric Roberts as the voice of a killer clown doll in a sorority. So I'm really proud of that one. It's very funny. So I've got those four titles coming out for Halloween. So it'll be on all the usual services, iTunes, Amazon, places like that, and of course on DVD. So we're just getting ready to deliver those four to all the platforms. We'll be launching those four movies on 109 countries at once. It'll be my first sort of worldwide footprint with a day and date across 109 countries. So we'll see how it all plays out. But you can find out more about the titles at rapidheart.com, which is my website, rapidheart.com, rapidheart. And kind of keep up with all my crazy goings on. I mean, I'm working in all the genres. Mike, I'm working in all the genres.
Yeah. I'm amazed. Like, are you out there tweeting about this stuff as well? I mean,
you can find me on Twitter at David Dakota on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram, Tumblr, Google, I'm pretty much Rapid Heart Pictures is the company. And you can pretty much find me on all the social media. And I've got a Roku channel now, Rapid Heart TV Roku channel. You can find us on Roku. It's a free channel. It's got all the makings of and trailers and tons of content on the Roku channel. You can download that for free. And then I've got a YouTube channel, which does really well, called rapidheart.tv. So pretty much if you go in there, you'll find a lot of the different sites and check out all the trailers of the movies and stuff like that. So I still even have a Yahoo fan group. So I started early on. So I adopted the new media early on. So I'm out there. It's pretty easy to find me. So just Rapid Heart Pictures or David Dakota, and you'll find all the sites, I'm sure, in some search engine.
Well, Mr. Dakota, thank you so much for your time tonight. This has been a real pleasure talking with you.
You too, Mike. And don't forget to check out the Sorority Babes and the Slimeball Bowlerama on Blu-ray. Grab it now while supplies last. Let's keep in touch, Mike. If you want to have another conversation, you've got my Skype ID. Let's do it again, okay?
Sounds great. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
If you enjoy this show and want more people to know about it, head on over to iTunes, leave a comment, and rate it 5 stars. Make sure you like and share us on Facebook, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Just search for Christopher Media. Thank you in advance for supporting Christopher Media by clicking on the PayPal button and by clicking through to all the sponsors who support ChristopherMedia.net. Most importantly, we would like to take the time to extend an extra special thanks to you. Christopher Media could not exist without your support. Thank you for visiting ChristopherMedia.net, and thank you for listening. Christopher Media. Let's make some noise.